This is a continuation of Monday, the 26th of February, 68. This is a continuation of on the reverse side of Channel 2. This is on the reverse side of Channel 2, and it's a continuation of Monday, the 26th of February. A continuation of Monday, the 26th of February.
Good many things. One of the Indian tribes, you see, was Don Nisiak. Another one was quiet in its life. They weren't made different, you know. Now, what Whitman found was that his vision, he could stand here, but in his mind, you see, he could go from place to place. And I can stand here and be right in a room and where I was, I remember, in 1930. I can see that just as clearly. And you see, your faces sort of look picture-like in the background as I see that particular picture. Now, just on the way home, I've been over there for 6 or 8 months. I was telling them goodbye. You see, I can see that just as clearly. Now that's what Whitman does here, and does in his poetry. Now this is the experience I have with the freshmen. They want to let their imagination run. I'm not interested in their imagination. I want their imagination to be based on information. I don't want them to just in their imagination cook up something that's never happened. The imagination has to reconstruct what happened. So if you think Whitman here is just imagining things that never happened, you see, then that's, you don't do him justice. I mean, the mind doesn't work like that if it has any control. And see, that's in 33. Now that puts a whole new, cubit to your stature. Gives you a whole new faculty if you want to follow him in that. Brings it close to the America of that time, of his time. Now, this is a continuation of it in a way. 34. He brings up, well, not necessarily. He brings up, relives a massacre in the Texas War in 34. And it becomes a part of his constitution. You see, it's not just something that he reads in the newspaper or reads in the history books. And then he does about the same thing, you see, in 35 and 36, an old-time sea fight, as he calls it. So that John Paul Jones and those seamen, you see, and Navy men of the Revolution, of the War of 1812, whenever it was, are part of his life. Now in 37 he does what he'd done before. Here he takes the point of view of the conquered in that sea fight. Not of the victors, but of the conquered, you see. And 38 he does the same thing. In 40 it's Virgil again. I do not despise you, priests, all time, the world over. And here are the terms in which he accepts the priest, and he also pictures himself as one of the new priests. Now, he doesn't just by extension. In 44, he's interested in what was being explored in his time of creative evolution, and that leads him into a kind of a reincarnation. He had sort of a semi-religious background. Now that's carried over to 45. That's a view of the universe, you see, now he's living that. It's not just what he's reading for curiosity. Now in 46 and 47, there's the open road theme again. You see, he won't put that in one little poem and leave it. It'll go all through him, all through his thought. I tramp a perpetual journey. And I teach straying from me, see, on the open road. Now he's talking about in 50, all the 48, 49, 50, he looks in himself and sees all these qualities. In 50, there is that in me, I do know what it is. But I know it is in me that is ineffable, you see, that he can't explain. And in 51 he says, do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. You see, this quality of consistency where the mind is not logical is something not very important. And then the ending in 52 is one of the high spots, I think, of it. You see, the spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. He complains of my gab and my loitering. But I, too, am not a bit untamed. I, too, am untranslatable, you see, like the hawk. I sound my barbaric yap over the rooftops of the world. Now, the hawk doesn't exactly have a yap, but he's picking it up from the hawk. The last gut of day holds back for me. It flings my lightness after the rest, and it coaxes me to the vapor and the dust. I depart as air. I shake my white locks in the far runaway sun. I choose my flesh in eddies and drifted and lacy jags. Now, this part of Whitman I haven't gone into. You see, this is that mystical part of Whitman where he can enter into this trance, so to speak, just by an act of will, allowing his mind, you see, to I don't even have the words to express it. You can get into it. You see what he's doing. That's one side of Whitman, and it's not in any of the others that we've read. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless and filter and fiber your blood. Failing to fetch me at the first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere waiting for you. Deliberately wrote to you personally. That is, he had that in mind as he wrote these things. Now, there's one part about this we ought to take time, whether we have time or not, just to look at the structure of his lines and his stanzas or his paragraphs or his sections. But I think you might this is an Emerson. I don't know that he expresses in so many words, but it's in his practice. You see how he writes his essays. It's almost as if a person, the reader, has to know the thought before he reads it. He has to struggle for the meaning. Now, that's from the reader's point of view. But now, what Emerson is saying is, if he organizes his thought so that it's easily understandable, then it's not his any longer. What he has thought, you see, has been contaminated by organization. He can carry that practice just so far, you know. Sooner or later, he has to be coherent. But what he's saying is that he doesn't have to abide by the little rules, you see. So that one of the hindrances of the individual is what I'd call in general art. And in his prose and these theoretical statements, you see, Whitman says he doesn't want those smooth, pretty verses any longer. Well, that makes it hard on the reader. I want to run with you through into this the Democratic Vistas. I think, in a way, that is more. After you read the other now, this will bring some of Whitman to a point. I won't start at the very beginning. Out of such considerations, such truths arises for treatment in these vistas the important question of character, of an American stock personality with literatures and arts for outlets. For my part, I would alarm and caution either political and business reader, and to the utmost extent, against the prevailing delusion that the establishment of free political institutions and plentiful intellectual smartness with general good order, physical plenty, industry, and so forth, do of themselves determine and yield to our experiment of democracy the fruitage of success. Now, see, what he's saying there is a prevailing delusion. Now, when Whitman is not an educated man, but he's not foolish. And when he uses the word delusion, it's a strong word. The prevailing delusion, you see, that the establishment of free institutions guarantees the fruits that we seek. With such advantages at present fully or almost fully possessed, the Union just issued victorious from the struggle, and with unprecedented materialistic advancement, I don't know what page I'm on in your book. 467. I'm going to get one of those books. That's going to blow away anyhow. And with the unprecedented materialistic advancement, you see, our country has had this unprecedented materialistic advancement for so long. Society in these states is cankered, crude, superstitious, and rotten. Now, if you can make it any stronger, I don't know how you do it. Political, a law-made society is, and private, a volunteer society is also. If it wasn't for Emerson, I'd join the march out there. I'd leave anything else, but I won't leave Emerson for that. In any vigor, I mean Whitman. Maybe Whitman would join him, I don't know. I say we like best.
That's the march in support of the teachers. They're marching down to the courthouse, and a good many of the students in the faculty were going, and I kind of wanted to go myself, but as I said, I didn't want to leave Whitman for you.
Now, you see, you can read that. The aim of all the literatures. Now, here's the people with literary tastes, and that's why he never has any literary tastes. Of course, it's a bad thing. The aim of all the literatures is to find something to make fun of. A lot of churches, sects, the most dismal phantasms I know, usurp the name of religion, and all that go on. You read that. If you think, if anyone thinks that you see in this this American version of Platonic idealism that these people close their eyes to anything, you read these pages long here. I say, and the like of these completely satisfy my senses of power, fullness, and motion. Give me through such senses an appetite. Let me see. I'm taking a page. Now look at literature. As to the political section of democracy, which introduces, now this is over a little farther, and I don't know this where it is, this paragraph beginning. As to the political section of democracy. You got that page? 472. Which introduced and breaks ground for further and vast sections, few probably of the mind, even these public states, that fully comprehend the absence of the phrase, you see, Lincoln's phrase, which we inherit. a formula whose verbal shape is homely wit and so on. The people, like our huge earth itself, which to ordinary scansion is full of vulgar contradictions and offense. Man, viewed in the lump, displeases, and is a constant puzzle and affront to the merely educated classes. The rare cosmical artist mind, lit with the infinite, alone confronts his thing. Now, the next paragraph. Literature, strictly considered, has never recognized the people. And whatever may be said, does not today. And his next thought is, the movements of the late secession war, or the Civil War, did that one thing exclusively in the unnamed, unknown rank and file, and how the brunt of the labor of death was to all central purposes volunteered. The war itself and the fighting of this rank and file justified, you see, the claims of democracy. But what he's just saying is that the learned and the literary have never valued the people. And I don't know that that's in a different state than it was then. You know, even with the schools in this country, you've got a tremendous gap in outlook and abilities. Or you've got I don't know. Now you're not interested in this. I am to some extent. On the political side, oh, you've just got so many people, you see, who's I don't know how to explain it, who have no mental horizon at all. One of Whitman's great disillusionments was he found that these hack drivers in New York couldn't read what he wrote. Now, isn't it amazing? The artistic mind makes some of the greatest blunders in the world. It's clear in some ways, you see, but at the same time it makes these tremendous blunders. And then if you ask an artist, a writer, a novelist, which is the best thing he's done, he may pick out something, you see, that nobody else even would carry home. You ask Mark Twain what's the best thing he did, he wouldn't say Huckleberry Finn. He'd say Letters from Heaven or something like that that was polemic. But Captain Stormfield's Profession or something like that. He just likely to say that's something that we value highly. Now let me go with it just a little bit more in here. Now, after the break there, he says, meanwhile, general humanity has always, in every department, been full of perverse maleficence, and is so yet. In downcast hours, the soul thinks it always will be, but soon recovers from such sickly moods. I myself see clearly enough the crude, defective streaks in all the strata of the common people, the specimens and vast collections of the ignorant, the credulous, the unfit, and uncouth, incapable, the low, and the poor. But now what brings this out of it? Oh, it's a tremendous debacle. Oh, it was one of the, it's a wealthy period, but it's one of the debasing eras in our history. Grant's administration, you see, where honesty was just lost sight of. Now, that's what he's reacting to. After the Civil War, you see, the gates were just open. All the old restraints, you see, were just lost. Now, there they are. Now, he says, look, just read to him and you'll see so many things. In the next paragraph, I say the mission of government henceforth in civilized land is not enforcing the law only, but it's also being an institution, you see, that educates people. Now, that line of thought would tell you into some interesting things. law and the courts through the 19th century.
Say, why don't you go talk to man about this?
Were a part of everybody's life. Large town, small town. You see, just the picture of what went on in a trial in the court.
It's not close enough to this thought.
People want to see it. Now that means, you see, that the prosecutor and attorney and the defense attorney were characters in people's imagination. Now that can be mischievous when the prosecutor and attorney, you see, uses all the trickery.
You know what?
He can almost undermine the community. And make tricksters out of them, and manipulators. Now, Whitman, all of that is in Whitman's mind. I went to a lawyer one time, and I had a little trouble. I told him I wanted to get around trouble. You know, he didn't ask me what I wanted to do to get me out of trouble. He asked me what the facts of the case were. I was shocked. And put out. I thought, Lord help us, I can't come down here and get a lawyer and pay him to get me out of trouble. He wouldn't do it. He was just going to argue the facts. Now, you see, that's a civil, decent way of doing it. I was trying to corrupt the lawyer, you see. Now, you have all those fine points, and what he's saying here now is the average man of the land only is important, and the democracy, he says, is the best way of working. Democracy, too, is law, and of the strictest, amplest kind. Many suppose that it means a throwing aside of law and running riot. But briefly, it is superior law. Democracy is superior law. Now, you see, the events are carrying him into an inquiry into the nature of democracy. And we are still involved in that, of course. What I've been trying to do is run through some of this material. Now, if you would, I'll give you just a minute to look back over your papers there and raise some points. That's all I wanted to do, just to suggest. I want to show you. Now, this lasted a good while. And this view or this feeling or whatever it is you see underwrote Emily Dickinson and Mark Twain and, in a way, Faulkner Fielder. It survived in some cases, but by and large, it collapsed. And what I think, I don't know. I just hate. In a way, you see, what you wanted to find out is what happened to what has happened to us in this country. We can't look back and just pick out and live with what we prefer. We've got to live with it all. And this little fragile detective story, so to speak, Turn of the Screw, will show you what happened to it. But you can't get it out by yourself. I don't believe you can carry that story much farther than just where they saw the ghost. I want to see how you, I'll give you a chance. But in it is the whole, is the downfall of all this material that we talked about. Thoreau, Whitman, Hawthorne, all this. Great things.
Now, that's the end of Monday, the 26th of February. That is the end of Monday, the 26th of February. And that's on the reading here of 285. 285. And that's on Channel 2 Over. Channel 2 Over. And it's the end of Monday, the 26th of February. This is beginning of Friday, 1st of March. We had a test on Wednesday, the 28th of February, and I didn't tape any. And this is Friday, and this is really the first day of Turn of the Screw. This is the first day of Turn of the Screw, the 1st of March. This is Friday, 1968.
And if you can, watch your own thinking on it. I think we'll cover enough ground this morning where you can watch the thing come out. Now this you can't do by yourself. And what I can tell you, I didn't learn by myself. I learned from talking about it with people just like you. And what I've learned actually, I tell you what. I learned the most. No, I won't take your time for doing that. Let's talk a little bit and let me raise some of your questions and we'll talk a little bit and then I'll ask you this, write this question on the board for you. What is it you think about now? You're trying to get all these things straight in school?
What she actually said was, I don't know, I felt a little shock. She asked me if there was a Freudian interpretation. And the way she said it was that if sex had something to do with the governess. And I think she had in mind that the governess and Mrs. Groves were involved, as well as maybe the governess was competing with the old governess and all like that. And what I did was pass it to the term that they use in the book, infatuation.
specified. Say they said he played hooky, or he hit somebody on the head, or he stole something. There's a letdown. Now that's, you see, James was interested and learned so much from Hawthorne. He said he did, and he wrote on Hawthorne. One thing that Hawthorne is interested in is the representation of evil. That's in a scholarly letter. I don't go into that. I'm not much interested in it. Yeah, I am too. That's another side, you see, of Emerson. Emerson makes that basic in that passage that I said to you.
They took the test in about 15 minutes, I'd say, and I was trying to think how I would connect that passage. I didn't want to go into that. We weren't ready for it. Actually, the test should be, according to my little system, it should be the second day. We should have this first day on the, well, what I do here is to take it in this idyllic sense that I talk about. And I wanted somehow, it just occurred to me, I'm needed to conduct that passage. And that's the passage in which Flora is transformed. Just all at once, you see, she and the governor face each other, and her countenance becomes ugly. And what James was saying, of course, is some Freudian, a psychological thing, is, you see, the loyalty is lost, and the world is different to them. So I picked that up with this beautiful picture of Flora to start with.
Paragraph. chapter 1. I had no drop again till the next day, for I was carried triumphantly through the following hours of my introduction to the youngest, the younger of my pupils. The little girl, now look at that. The little girl who accompanied Mrs. Gross appeared to me on the spot. A creature so charming as to make it a good fortune to have to do with her. She was the most beautiful child I ever saw. Now look at the picture of this little girl in the, at the peak of that scene by the lake. And that face, once you see that face of the little girl in this scene you just written about at the lake, you'll never forget it. If you actually see that face of this same little girl, you see, you'll never forget it. Now, what is the cause of the transformation? Childish talk about it, and it would result in half an hour about becoming immense friends. Now that, you see, is she's getting into this new world of the old manor house. Now the manor house is the finest tradition in our whole civilization, and it was right at the heart of the 19th century. Final retirement, a small inform alone. at one point she says that she lived in a world of their invention. They played games, they charades, and all those things. It was a world of the children. Now let me tell you, that children's world in the 19th century. I don't know. In our time, it seems like the humanities course, just comes to mind, is organized for people your age to confront these great disillusionments that our civilization has faced. Freud, you see, is one of them. He made us a part of the animal world, that bodily conditioning. You see, we look at what happened in the Shakespeare, where the universe was transformed.
I might say I struggle here to remember some of those high points of the humanities courses. You see, Darwin made us physically a part of the animal world, and Freud psychologically, mentally, a part of the animal world. Thank you.
say what happened. I think the one part that you ought to take seriously, and you don't know whether to or not until you study it, so is in the introduction or the first part, just before chapter one, where they're talking in this English country house long afterwards now. And the teller, the narrator, gives a rundown, which you don't know how to take, of the girl. The first of these touches conveyed that the written statement took up at the tail of the point after it had the matter begun. The fact to be in possession of was, therefore, that his old friend, the youngest of several daughters of a poor country parson, had at the age of 20, on taking service for the first time in the schoolroom, come to London in trepidation to answer in person an advertisement that had already placed her in brief correspondence with the advertiser. And there she meets this, she conceives him as rich. Well, that paragraph, you see where I was reading? That first chapter of the thing. It's the very first one. That really is enough, but he tells you more about it. A country, one of the several daughters of a poor country parson. Now, she refers to her upbringing and her home in here. She gets, while she's at this, at the manor house, she gets letters from home. Don't you remember that? And they are disagreeable. Now, that's necessary for the story. You see why? She has this deprived childhood. And now, all at once, you see the world has opened up.
Separate, you see, she's not withdrawing. But this is the first time she's actually had a chance, you see.
see to engage the world. Now you see her as a commoner, yes. You also see her as a single person. That's what Ensign calls for, you see. Now, from his point of view, what you want to see first, I think, is some quality. She had like Hester. You see, as we went back and looked at Hester, that first scene showed her as a person of great proportions. Now, what greatness or what elevation is there that you see in the governess? Now, that, I think, is a fundamental difference in the Emersonian and the Freudian approach. Now, the thing about James is that he has both. And in a way, you might say, he glorifies the governess. He makes of her an extraordinary kind. I don't know whether to leave it here overnight or not. Just let you face it in these terms. What is it now? Could you pick out some passages that show the governess as a sort of elevated person like Hester and throw at his best? I don't know whether to leave it at that or not. You don't want to leave it up there, do you? Now let's talk. We've got 2 minutes. Let's talk. What are you going to say there? You ought to do is watch your own mind as it takes hold of the story. Yes, ma'am.
One of the boys had the last word on it. He said he couldn't see any greatness to her. It looked like she was just going batty. And that's the end of this 1st of March, Friday, and the first full day of talking about turn of the screw. And Hulsey had the last word. He couldn't see anything great about the governess, she was just plain batty.